Yeah, my name is Yang Hu. I'm at the NASA Langley. In the Calypso team, which is a LIDAR mission. And first, I want to thank Daria and the other organizers to give me this chance to learn from the scientists in the room. How do I?
The pointer.
Yeah.
This green line.
It doesn't move.
It may not move. You may have to push a button.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, so I'll first introduce a little bit about Calypso measurements, and which is the satellite we have been flying the last 12 years. And now, then I will talk a little bit about the next generation of LIDAR that we're talking about putting in space. We just finished the Earth Science Decadal Survey, and our LIDAR, the next generation LIDAR, is one of the first designated missions. So we're in the process of trying to design the next generation LIDAR, and we were asked by Varnik and NASA headquarters to accommodate as much science as possible under the cost constraint. So so the opportunity here to learn from you guys can help me understand what kind of no-hanging fruit may be out there that we can accommodate some of the requirement in the system design. And now also talk a little bit about the new direction we're going with the small set and CubeSat and the potential relevance to the community here.
Your microphone a little bit closer to your...
Oh, okay.
Be here.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, thank you. So the first profiling LIDAR in space is in 94 when we put our group put the LIDAR on a space shuttle. We flew for about 53 hours on the air. So it's the first time we had a global measurement of the boundary layer, but it was very noisy because that's more than 20 years ago. Our laser and the detectors are not as good as now.
This is above the ocean or below the ocean?
Oh, this is above the ocean. This yeah, the ocean is this white line. It's very, very huge signal on the white line. So we launched the Calypso satellite in 2006. So we have two lasers on that. It was supposed to run for 2 years, but it has been keep going so far. And hopefully we may have a couple more years if we have enough field. So the measurements is mainly designed for Earth and cloud. So it's a so the boundary layer studies are not really a main kind of driver. It's mostly free troposphere, clouds, and everything. So, and some kind of studies has been done. I mean, about the may be relevant to this community. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So the Calypso payload, the primary payload is a LIDAR. So we have two wavelengths, polarization sensitive channels on that. One is the 532 green laser, and one is 1064 nanometer. And then we have the camera, the 670 nanometer. And also we have infrared images. And these are primarily targeting clouds. So these are the primary mission, the cloud and Earth. So we can figure out what kind of clouds we are looking at, whether it's liquid or ice, and what type of Earth we are looking at. So those are the primary missions. So I don't want to go too much about it. So so apparently we can do a boundary layer to a certain degree, so we can see the clouds and aerosols in the boundary layer. And we can tell the boundary layer top height pretty easily with a little bit of averaging. I mean, it's quite still very noisy during the daytime, but it's, but with a little bit kind of spatial averaging or some signal processing to denoise the image, we can figure out the boundary height. One of the things I did is to derive the ocean surface wind. So basically, it's very similar to the scalarometer, but this is for the 532 and 1064 nanometers. So we can focus on the capillary gravity waves. So basically the lower wind or backscatter. I mean, if you consider regular Fresnel reflection, 2% of light hits the surface, gets bounced back at a very low wind speed. Most of the light will come back very, very focused. And then with the highest wind speed, that backscatter light will be spread to a bigger cone. So it depends on where we are looking at. If we're pointing very much at nadir, then at the lower wind speed, we'll have very, very high reflectance. At high wind speed, our reflectance will reduce. So basically, as a result, our measurements, normally we are pointing at 3 degrees off nadir. So our measurements basically is the normalization factor here. So it's basically the, if you have the S is the variance of the surface slopes, surface, I mean the capillary gravity wave slopes, so it's a function of wind. So we can derive this wind at the crystal footprint level, which is 70 meters. So it does compare pretty well with the AMSR, the microwave measurements. AMSR is on the Aqua satellite, which is 75 seconds ahead of us. So we do compare pretty well by using the crystal merged wave slope variance. And if we look at the details, okay, the x-axis is the microwave measurements of the wind, and the y-axis is the crystal wind speed. We can see that we have a huge spread around it, mainly because our footprint is much smaller, so it's equivalent to a few seconds for the wind measurements. So it's very, very big changes. And also, the crystal, the measurements also extend into the ocean. So we collect the in the atmosphere, our beam size is 30 meters. So in the water, it's 1.3 times shorter. So it's about 22 meters in water, the beam size. So we do have the capability of measure the profile in a certain portion of the water. And then these are the vertical kind of sampling of the calypso. So over here, we're mostly using the perpendicular channel of the green wavelengths to look into the particular backscatter, because our measurements mostly are sensitive to the particular backscatter. So the cross polarization basically is done by the nine spherical particles, mostly the phytoplanktons in water, and the molecular scatter is in the co-polarization mostly. So we could use the perpendicular channel of the green laser to look at what's in the water, and the upper figure is the crystal's ocean subsurface integrated turn. So we just add everything in the water together. Our signal is not very strong, so we have to integrate them to get very kind of high SNR.
And is it sensitive to the size of the phytoplankton as well as the lack of
sensitivity? Yeah.
So there have to be about half a micron.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not the same that's necessarily mm-hmm. coming out in the ocean color measurement. It's a very different measure.
We are probably a little bit sensitive to the mostly 2 to 20 microns or so of the phytoplankton size, maybe 1 micron. And so when it gets too small, like when it gets to the Rainy regime, it becomes less depolarizing. So it becomes more Rainy-like and molecular-like. So we're not sensitive to the very, very tiny non-algal particles. You're exactly right. The backscatter normally is sensitive to all of the size because they are mostly they're not making the polarized measurements like we did. So we also could derive the particular backscatter by using the integral return multiplies the absorption. Basically, the integral return is the backscatter of the particle divided by the absorption. So the absorption we can derive it because the vertical profile, the part of the backscatter in the mixed layer, normally it's relatively well mixed. So the vertical profile of the backscatter changes logarithmically. So it basically reduces very very well. So we use the vertical kind of the differences of the two or three bins, we can derive the absorption, the attenuation, and our integral return multiplied the attenuation will give us the particular backscatter. So those are different seasons of particular backscatter. So basically, in the summer season, you got much more backscatter at high latitudes. So this is exactly what you mentioned. So the right hand side is the MODIS derived the backscatter at 531. They have one channel in the air, so we can derive particular backscatter over in the air. So we use that particular backscatter divided by 10. Normally, the particular depolarization ratio of the particular backscatter is about 10%. So you compare somewhat well with Calypso, but there's a difference in the joy because probably there are a lot more viruses or whatever is in the joy, and that's not depolarizing. But the MODIS is capturing that. We don't have that. We also develop algorithms to derive the particular organic carbon from that. So I don't want to talk too much into that. Also, we were able to derive the inherent property of aerosol in the boundary layer. So here is the example of the measurements of the aerosol extinction cross-section divided by backscattering cross-section, which basically tells it's very sensitive to referee indexes and size, mostly size, and a little bit of referee indexes. So we can more or less tell a lot of those boundary aerosols are biological driven because if we look at where this NIDA ratio really are high, which means it's more likely biological particles, and they're almost always at the places that we have lots of pushing and biological activities. And within this 12 years of measurements, we can look at the monthly results of the clouds and the aerosols and ocean. So those are the anomaly divided by monthly mean. So the red one is the ocean subsurface, the phytoplankton backscatter anomaly. The blue is the cloud, the water clouds in the boundary of water clouds. So the green is the aerosol measurements, the aerosol radiation measurements. So we do see the clouds and the ocean subsurface agree pretty well, but the aerosol seems like are not always agreeing too well with it. I think probably the continental transport we have to find a way to remove them. So they're not completely, kind of coordinated. So what's more important is what we're gonna do now, because all these kind of measurements are technologies of more than 20 years ago. So now we're given a certain amount of money to do the next mission now. So, the question is what we're going to do with it, because we do have a very, very small kind of cap on what we can spend, and And there has been a guideline in the Digital Service kind of saying that some of the things we want to do may be too expensive. And so we're still in the discussion on what we do. So the first thing we want to do for the next missions, we want to have higher vertical resolution. So we're thinking more like 1 meter. So we don't know whether it's good enough or not. And do we want to go higher? Those are the things that I think by discussing with the people in the room can help us figure out what can help. So we're thinking right now it's about 1 meter of sampling, because we have to apply some low-pass filter, so we may have effective resolution of 2 to 3 meters. We don't know if it's necessary enough. If we need more, we probably have to have more downlink requirement, which will increase the cost a little bit. So those are the things we want to find out. But one of the main drivers for this is to look for the vertical change in the mixed layer to look at the particular kind of backscatter the layers in there. Sometimes near the coastal region we do see different layers that are associated with internal waves. And another part we really want to put in is the spectral measurements. So this new mission we're asked to do is mainly still focus on aerosols. So we're trying to measure not just the backscatter by the particles. We want to also separate that from the molecular return, and that's through the spectral, because the molecules they move at 700 meters per second. So there's quite a broadening due to the Doppler broadening due to the motion. So we hope that you have some spectral measurements so that we can separate the molecules from aerosols in atmosphere, and then that now we can measure backscatter and the attenuation, because we know what without aerosol we know what the atmosphere profile the air look like. So if the air is the backscatter is lower, then what do we expect? We know how much attenuation by aerosol is in there. So we can measure the extinction of the clouds and aerosols there. But in the water, that's what we really want to do, is the measurements of the baryon scattering. So in the water, the molecular scatter, they have a Doppler shift, mainly because in the water, the molecular scattering due to the density kind of fluctuation that moves at the speed of sound. So as a result, the molecular scattering in water always shift about 7.5 gigahertz away from the laser wavelengths. So we want to resolve that. And from there, we can measure the molecular return at the same time as the particular return in the middle. So it's under the baryon scattering, it also can tell us something about the temperature and the salinity, because the molecular scattering, the frequency shift is sensitive. It's mostly a function of the sound speed, which is determined by the compressibility of the water. So the temperature and the pressure can change the exact location of the broadening and also the width of the broadening. So we hope we could use the measurements to at least tell us how they are changing vertically. We may not be able to tell exactly what is 20 degree or 20.1 degree, but we may be able to tell whether they are changing or not. So here's basically what we can get in summary, what we might be able to get for the next generation of the LiDAR in space. We definitely will get better boundary layer height retrievals, because now we're having the molecular channel and the particle channel, particularly in the channel, so we ratio them. Then we know that there will be a clear boundary between the free troposphere and the boundary layer, because the aerosol will be capped there. and the spectral, the higher resolution on both spectral and the spatial feature can provide a better determination of boundary layer height. And we'll have the good measurements of aerosol upper depth profile and the typing. We can tell what type of aerosols more precisely. And the high spectral resolution has measurements also can help us tell the wind speed as well if we can do it with the little extra cost, because the wind will cause a shift of the center wavelengths. So on the ocean side, we'll be able to profile the vertical change of the phase dependent back scatter directly. And the there's ways that we can use this new light that you detect bubbles much better, and we can there's potential to determine the vertical change of temperature and salinity. So this is one of the examples of the new generation of LiDAR versus the crystal measurements. So these are one of our field measurements. We try to tell what we may look at with the new LiDAR in the future. And then this is field campaign measurements. We use the aircraft measurements, and then we compare with what eclipse measurements may look like. So these are using the aircraft measurements, but downgraded to the space. So this is the in-water measurements from the aircraft. This was the high resolution. So we had the high spatial and the spectral resolution measurements we have. So we could profile the things in water. With the current detector we have, we run out of signal probably around upper depths, absorption upper depths about 2 or 3, depends on averaging. If we average a little bit, we can go more, 3 or 4. But once we go a little deeper, a lot of noise come up, and the floor level noise kind of is killing us. So we're trying to find newer detectors which with much lower noises, so that we can push the detecting depths a little further. Also, we're looking at the blue laser as well, because the green, there's multiple absorption by water. The water absorption is about 0.05 per meter. But if we're moving into the blue, you can go down to 0.01 per meter. So that will really increase the detecting limit into the water. So there's lots of wind measurements that I didn't mention, because the ESA is going to finally launch their wind LiDAR. So it's not similar to our HSL, but then they're focusing on the wind. So the configuration is different. We have been measuring the wind with coherent technology for the last 30 years on the ground and aircraft. Ball Aerospace has proposed wind LiDAR, which is basically HSIL we're thinking about for the space station, but unfortunately was not selected. But in the future, those are achievable in the very, very near future. And there's something else that I'm involved in, which is trying to put to miniaturize the LiDAR in space. So the main problem we had in the past is the LiDAR, only 5% of the energy converts into light, and then lots of heat we can get rid of, and then we need a big power to improve our SNR, so it gets very expensive. So we're trying to make it less expensive by miniaturize everything. So one of the things we've done is we were able to reduce the the laser size to a small fraction. So we submit a proposal recently to put a laser as powerful as Calypso, but we put it in a 6U kind of CubeSat. 6U is like 6 meter, very, very small satellite. But the telescope is small, so our signal is very weak. But so we're trying to do the three-dimensional mapping of the clouds, because the CubeSat, the good thing for CubeSat is we can spin very fast. It's like every minute about 100 degrees of spinning. So we can spin very fast, and we can keep staring at the clouds so that we can look at its structure. And also, we're trying to develop newer technology for the telescope, because the telescope is one of the things that can be very, very heavy. So we're developing newer diffractive kind of photon safe. So instead of reflecting kind of the light, we use the tiny, tiny holes, many, many billions of holes, you know, tiny, tiny thing that can diffract the light to the focal point, and everywhere else they will cancel out each other. So it would be a mesh and deployable, so that it can be folded and then expand them in the space, so that we have enough area to collect the light. And one of the CubeSat we just got funded to do by ONR is to use this kind of technology we just developed, and also we use the different kind of laser. It's a laser beam with vortex, so it's a laser beam with orbital angular momentum. So the photons has a spinning momentum, and also there are two kind of angular momentum. One is spinning momentum, which is the circular polarization. Another will be the orbital angular momentum, which is basically the relation between the photons. So there's a different kind of the angular momentum. We're trying to use this kind of laser. It's like a donut shaped laser. It's developed mostly by the free space communication group. So they try to use this kind of momentum, because in this. The spinning angular momentum is only one bit for the communication guys. It's left hand or right hand. But the orbital angular momentum can go from minus infinity to plus infinity. So it's a big, big bandwidth for them. So what they found is when they put the laser with angular momentum into the free space for the communication, turbulence always destroyed the angular momentum, because the angular momentum is more like a phase. And then when you have turbulence, you have the change in the free index that will kind of kill the angular momentum. So we're trying to use their kind of noise as our signal. So we say, okay, we probably could use if we can measure the orbital angular momentum with the photon safe. Actually, we develop a new photon safe, a spiraling photon safe that is very sensitive to the design, the angular momentum. So we can measure how much change in angular momentum we see, and then use that, we can map it to the CN square measurements. And this is part of the study that I'm working with the Naval Research Lab folks. Oh, I think this is it. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Questions?
Thanks. Not a measuring guy. Can you, a couple things. Can you scan? Mm-hmm. Have you ever compared your wind measurements with SAR, like Dudley Chelton?
No.
And can you measure the winds? I mean the waves.
Good question. Yeah, the we haven't scanned it yet. Yeah, there is a chance. This one of the things that we're trying to deal with the ONR folks, the naval folks, is trying to put a laser on the CubeSat and we scan it, because the ocean surface return is huge. Sometimes they would saturate our detector. So we can afford to do it on the CubeSat so we can scan it. And we haven't done that, but I think it's possible to do. And it's also one of the area we're thinking about, putting one laser, but multiple receiver, so that will give you a different direction and we may be able to compare that with the SAR results. And I forgot the second question.
Can you measure the wave height?
Oh, the wave height, yeah. Yeah, it's possible. There are different modes of LiDAR. One is the altimeter mode, and one is, for us, it's a profiling mode. So I developed a method, the so-called super resolution kind of a technique, which can make the vertical profiling LiDAR into the altimeter mode. So for that, we estimated if we sample about 1 meter per 1 meter vertically, we may achieve, with the no pass filter, we use the match filter technique, we can achieve accuracy probably into a few, 2 or 3 centimeters or so of accuracy. So from there, we should be able to get the wave height information. And also, we're talking about doing imaging, so that we will have very, very high resolution kind of wave, it's three-dimensional structure. We developed the technology with Bohr Aerospace for the vegetation measurements in the past, and we demonstrated some of that. But for the vegetation, it's a little bit, because the leaves also have holes, so we're unable to really tell how accurate it is. But we're able to do a very, very good three-dimensional structure of the treetops. But I'm pretty sure we can do the wave heights if there is that requirement. Yeah, right now, most of our requirements are from the cloud and aerosol community, so we never thought about pushing that direction. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Impressive set of measurements you can do, of course.
Thank you.
Especially with aerosol, where really we need a lot of information. Mm-hmm. I'm following more or less your question. Mm-hmm. You have shown at the beginning that when you measure wind,
yeah,
you compare with other measurement.
Yeah.
And of course, you find more or less as a general pattern of the world. But what about quantification? Do you have an idea how accurate you can actually be?
We haven't really had any validation. So from theory, we know. So our SNR for the surface return is very high. It's like several hundred. So it's for a single shot. So we know the uncertainty of the radiometric measurements. So we know it's probably less than 1%. So around 1%, 1 or 2% probably. Yeah. So it depends on the wind speed. The lower the wind speed, the higher SNR we have. So with the higher wind, we have reduced SNR. From the theory, I think the theory are pretty solid. I mean, as long as we kind of believe Cox Monk's kind of a model for the surface slope versus the wind speed. So that way we kind of have some kind of estimation of uncertainty. But we didn't have any kind of comparison with buoy or something like that, because we are a curtain. So we don't really go directly add any kind of buoy or other in situ kind of sensors that we can compare and really estimate the uncertainties.
You should be able to compare statistics, after a while.
Yeah, yeah. The statistics we do compare pretty well with MSIR and also we compare the similar method with one we can get from CloudSat, which is another satellite with carrying the K-band kind of radar. So from a near surface return, the wind results compare pretty well with what we have. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Here. Yeah, I was wondering when you're showing your aerosol retrieval, and you said that from biological origin and that they are correlated with phytoplankton.
Yeah.
However, when you look at the major features, they were mostly, I would say they correlate more with terrestrial source of aerosols.
Yeah, coastal is.
No, but even like in Indian Ocean, they extend very far. Oh, so can you really discriminate between biological origin from terrestrial and from
no, I cannot.
Ocean?
I'm just guessing because it's the number, the extinction versus backscattered, the ratio is much, much bigger.
But it could be from terrestrial.
Yeah, you could.
Okay.
You could. but the yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. What is your definition of the height? Because you are saying that. The satellite from this LIDAR, it's possible to identify the height of the boundary layer.
Yeah.
And what is the definition? What do you consider as the height of the boundary?
Right now, we're basically looking at the discontinuity of the backscatter itself. So, of the backscatter. So,
backscatter.
So
the level of backscatter is turbulence.
It's by the aerosols mostly.
Yeah.
So we're assuming that the aerosols kind of are mostly in the trapped in the boundary layer.
Yeah. You showed for like particles for aerosols, or you were talking also in the future about bubbles. You're showing backscatter value. Do you have a way to get to a concentration?
The concentration of the bubbles.
Or aerosols?
The aerosols, the concentration, good question. we probably have to have some multiple wavelengths, like if we have a 532 and the 335 and 1064, if we look at the size and the backscatter together, we may get the number concentration. Or we can just combine it with passive sensors. Yeah. So it's not kind of uniquely defined. It's more like what we have is mostly optical properties. To translate that into the number concentration, we probably need some extra constraint. Yeah. For the bubble, I don't know. the way we, I'm thinking about bubbles is the bubbles they can change the compressibility, and as a result, they drastically reduce the sound speed, so you can see very, very huge change in the Brillouin scattering kind of the frequency shift. So that we think we can detect it pretty well, but it's also not exactly, we haven't figured out to what part of the bubble property we're sensitive to. Yeah.
Has anyone tried to use Calypso data, and especially sort of aerosol backscatter, to look at boundary layers over complex terrain, i.e. over mountainous terrain?
I haven't seen, I think there have been some papers for like a just case study, but not a really scientific kind of German studies yet. Yeah, because I think, I haven't seen a lot of kind of papers on that yet, no.
And for the ocean measurements, is there a limitation from orbit or interference with sunlight on measuring the diurnal cycle? I mean, and over that resolution, that's what it's going to be interesting.
Actually, there's one paper we're ready to publish. It's looking at the day and night difference. So we compare it with the ship measurements for all the ship measurements we can ever found. They agree pretty well, and it kind of can indicate the migration of zooplankton. Mm-hmm. We're submitting it in a few days.
So we're in there, you have something about variations, subsurface variations in temperature and salinity that you might be able to measure. I think I saw that. And I was waiting for that to come around. And I think I've heard an explanation once, but maybe you can explain it and how it's possible from spaceborne LIDAR.
Yeah, from space probably would be I mean, right now, this is still at the beginning. So the ship, there has been some ship-based measurements. So so the spaceborne, we may have to do a lot of kind of averaging to figure out the vertical change of it. So the principle is very, very simple. The principle is basically the broadening. I mean, not broadening, the frequency shift of the molecular black scatter, the brown scatter, is proportional to the sound speed, basically to the compressibility of the water. So for the ice, for solid also, it has this kind of shift, but ice has two sound speed, so it has two peak. So we can use the similar technique to measure the thickness of ice as well. So but here for the water, this shift, normally like at 27 C, it's about 7.5 gigahertz of a shift. So the backscatter, the signal, would be 7.5 gigahertz plus and minus, I mean, the center wavelengths of the laser. So, but that 7.5 is not exactly always near. It's going from 7 to 8 gigahertz. So it depends on temperature and salinity. And also the width, because that is not the wavelength is not just one single wavelength. The shift has multiple waves. Also, the waves also depends on the salinity as well. But the difficulty for us is to lock the frequency and figure out exactly where the shifted distribution really look like. But by looking at the vertical change of it, yeah, we should be able to see some vertical change of it. We may not be able to precisely determine exactly what temperature it is, but if there's some change, we can find out. Yeah, so probably if with some microwave measurements, which is very sensitive to the skin, to anchor it, we may be able to get the whole profile.
Is that really just temperature?
It's mostly temperature. Salinity also contributes to it, yeah. Yeah, so it's the two combined, so we have to figure out ways to separate them.
Okay, let's take one more time. Yeah,
thank you.
So now we have a short afternoon break. We're back at 3 o'clock.